This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome, welcome. In this program, we'll explore the new edge of climate science. Our guests dive into the ocean deep to find creeping dead zones stripped of oxygen. Another study describes a hot ending with scalding seas where heat-tolerant bacteria are the only survivors. Along the way, we get hints of how this planet works. It's your Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Scientists worry that oxygen will become depleted in the oceans due to global warming. One organizer of the upcoming Royal Society meeting on that topic is the American expert Peter Brewer. When it comes to ocean chemistry, Dr. Peter G. Brewer has been a leader for a long time. During his 24 years at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, his period at the National Science Foundation, and now his research position at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, Peter Brewer has published over 170 scientific papers and edited several books. He's been out on countless research ships and more recently is connecting with scientists in China. Peter's latest commentary, published in the AGU Journal of Geophysical Research, is dead on for our program today. It's titled Ocean Chemistry, Ocean Warming, and Emerging Hypoxia. Hypoxia means reduced oxygen. But I'm hoping we'll also find a couple of minutes for his earlier research into ocean acidification and the emergence of methane from the Arctic. Dr. Brewer joins us from the Monterey Bay, California. Peter, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, good morning to you.
I'll begin with the same question, if I may, that I asked your co-organizer, John Shepherd. Why is the Royal Society hosting this special conference of scientists about loss of oxygen in the seas?
Well, it's very timely, and we like to tackle puzzles, and we look at things that are understood in science, which things are not. And John Shepherd and I became pretty well convinced that this was a terribly unexplored problem that was ripe for solutions, so we'd like to put it to rights.
Can you recall when you first became aware of this problem?
Well, it was quite a while ago. I served on the IPCC panels, you know, the intergovernmental body that writes reports on climate change, and I began to be concerned as I looked at the chapter we were writing that I didn't think it was correct. So I voiced this concern to my colleagues and was basically told, you know, that this is not the place for original research. This is an assessment. And so if there's 20 scientific papers out there all saying the same thing, that's what we report. If you think they're wrong, then go away and write a research paper and come back and it'll be reviewed next time around. And that was probably staying within the rules. So we did so. And I tried to put it into my mind, well, what am I concerned about? What specifically do I think is misrepresented or not well represented at the moment? And after thinking it through, I worked it out. The concept is very simple. If every household has a refrigerator, if I look at mine, the manufacturer's recommendation is it should run at, I think, 37 degrees Fahrenheit. If your refrigerator was suddenly to run at 43 degrees Fahrenheit, you'd worry, your cheese would go off faster, you'd call tech support and so on. And that's what's happening to the ocean. It will get warmer, and so microbes will grow faster, things will break down faster. The trouble is that wasn't represented in the equations. It's very simple, but the fact that it's not been there is worrisome.
Well, is this oxygen loss from climate change, and I'm not talking about runoff from fertilizers, but climate change itself, is that a distant threat, or are there signs that it is already happening?
Oh, it's happening very strongly. Yes, plenty of signs. And the numbers look a little bit large, and that's what's got us concerned. And also, there are three main drivers for it. The simplest one is that warm water just dissolves less oxygen from the air. So if the ocean warms by 2 degrees Celsius, which it is going to do, then the oxygen solubility is lowered by about 14 micromoles per kilogram. And there's already plenty of parts of the ocean, in fact, right here off California, outside my office, where down around, 600 meters depth, there's already less oxygen than that. So we would go to zero there and have a true dead zone, not a talking point dead zone, but a dead zone with no oxygen, just from solubility. But that seems to be the smaller effect. When we look at the trends that are being observed in the ocean, then the solubility term accounts for about 15% of what we are seeing. About 85% is due to other causes, and people have been a little shy about describing why that is. On the physical side, the belief is that it's mostly due to what's called stratification. The surface of the ocean gets warmer, it's more stable, winter storms aren't as intense, The ocean doesn't take as deep a breath as it used to, less oxygen getting down there, and that's the big driver. On the chemical side, we point to the very classic reaction I just described. We use the laws of Van't Hoff and Arrhenius, written down in the late 1800s. And you see it every day. If you know the milk spoils, if you leave it out too long, things get warmer. And that effect seems to be large, too. The worrisome part is that those two things seem, or three things, seem to add together.
And I recall about 10 years ago, British scientist James Lovelock warned about ocean stratification and the risk to living systems, and he proposed installing a network of giant pipes to get the water moving. Are we talking about the same problem?
Well, stratification is the same problem. I don't think there's any way on this earth we could tackle it with giant pipes. Those are engaging ideas which make people think, you know, they stimulate the mind. But they're not in any way a practical solution in terms of cost or scale or volumes of water that can be moved. So these are mind games we play to stimulate ideas, but they're not practical.
Now, the Monterey Bay Aquarium and its research institute are famous for the study of sea life. What types of marine life would likely be the first victims of a change of oxygen in the seas?
Well, that's a very broad question. The specific thing we are looking at here is what happens when oxygen levels get very, very low. And then we get a set of consequences. Microbes start to do nasty things. But oxygen in general is a driver for a very large number of species, like salmon, for instance, like cold, well-oxygenated water. If it's warmer and a little bit less oxygen, they wouldn't like it. That's at the upper end of the scale. So it's likely that declining oxygen levels will cut across a very wide swath of things for marine life. It's tied in with temperature, too, that they don't operate independently. And so that as temperature changes, a whole body of other chemical and physical transport processes change, too. So we're dealing with multidimensional space. But everywhere we look, it's going to be harder for animals to respire. In the subsurface ocean, its oxygen levels will go down a bit, and it will be a bit tougher. We're going to start to squash marine life into a narrower band.
Now, something you said stimulated a worry that developed as I read your new paper and other papers on this topic, and that is that perhaps we won't see so much the dead zones, which do make headlines, as a general weakening of life in the sea, which will be harder to pinpoint, but could indeed come from this lack of oxygen.
Yes, you know, the combination of temperature and oxygen, together with ocean acidification, which will be mixed in with it, overall is not going to be good. And the problem is to try and see this with clarity. So we've identified a couple of key problems which can be crystal clear. These effects happen. And that's just the opening round. We'll be debating it at the Royal Society meeting, and I'm sure it will lead on to a whole bunch of other questions. I read a fascinating paper the other day pointing out that as we get ocean warming, we get a poleward migration of marine species. And some of them, of course, have got microbes in we don't like. And so you can start to track the northward progression of human diseases related to fish consumption because the fish are eating different things or the species that carry these microbes are migrating. There can be a cascade of effects, and we're just scraping the surface here.
I hadn't even considered that. We have seen some tropical fish showing up in the northern islands of British Columbia, but yes, they're going to have some microorganisms along with them.
Yes, and fisheries-related problems will start to crop up. Right now I'm looking at more glaring problems. If we can only account for 15% of the observed changes, what's driving the 85%? That would mean it could be six times bigger than what we're seeing so far. How large are these effects going to be, and how well can we simulate them? And if we just do the physics alone, we're not likely to get it. If we just do the chemistry alone, we're not likely to get it. We've got to find a way to put those two together.
And if you'll pardon a stupid question, but if we're going to lose oxygen from the sea, I'm assuming there's a relatively constant amount of oxygen on the Earth. Where does it go?
Well, the upper ocean, where phytoplankton grow, continues to grow. The upper ocean will be green. It will produce oxygen just as we go on now. You won't see any effect really in the atmosphere. But as those cells fall down and die and are consumed in the deep sea, those microbially driven chemical reactions will go faster. And so the familiar oxygen minimum zones, which are down a few hundred meters, will grow more intense. Particles falling down through the sea will be consumed by microbes a little bit faster, just like your refrigerator would rot things faster if it warmed up. And we'll start to see the areas of the ocean which are acutely low in oxygen start to expand their range and sneak upwards in the water column. That'll help to compress life zones. many, many animals can't tolerate very low oxygen levels, and we're talking we can go to zero. It's going to be a mess.
Before we get back to that, I'm wondering if we could take a short detour into work you published in 2013. It was in the journal Nature Geoscience, and the title is Marine Biochemistry, Arctic Shelf Methane Sounds Alarm. Dr. Brewer, what did you find out about Arctic methane, and how alarmed should we be?
I think that's interesting, but nowhere near the problem we're discussing here with oxygen. As I recall, the editors at Nature asked me to write a commentary on some observations from a Russian and U.S. team, finding huge numbers of gas vents on the floor of the Arctic Ocean. They use their sonar, they detect these plumes, they're huge, they're on the Russian shelf, and of course they want to sound the alarm about that. I had to be a little cautious. There's nothing that suggests those vents weren't there decades earlier. We don't know how soon they started. Most of that methane is consumed within the ocean. Rather little gets out to the atmosphere. So there's a few unknowns there. So it's a fascinating story. But in terms of a global threat, it's nowhere near the threat that we're going to get from oxygen losses in the ocean. I put in an aside in that review, which I thought was worrisome. The original paper that I was commenting on was dedicated to the lives of Russian sailors that were lost rescuing the Science Party. The rescue ship had set off and was hit by a nasty storm and sank. And, of course, it is quite possible that that storm would not have occurred and been that severe if there had been ice cover at that time of year, which there would have been a century ago. And there isn't now. We're losing ice in the Arctic. And it's showing up. It's storminess and changes. There's a whole cascade of human effects involved.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. My guest today is one of America's top oceanographers, Dr. Peter G. Brewer, and we've reached him at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute in California. So, returning to your latest paper, Peter, this April, I see it's really your second plea to get oceanographers to change methods now that oceans are warming. What has been the problem with previous methods?
Oh, I would have to confess, I think we've all been a bit lazy. About 50 years ago, people started to write out equations describing how oxygen consumption occurred in the ocean. And they said, well, it might be temperature, it might be the amount of organic matter, it looks like it's related to depth, got to do something. So let's write it out as a logarithmic function of depth. That way we cover our bases. And the first person to do that was, maybe 1962. And so the next person that came along said, well, that seemed to work, I'll write the equation that way too. And a pattern grew. One person does it, so the next one does, and the next one does. And we've kind of got away with writing out these equations as functions of depth, because it sort of worked. The problem with that is it's not specific about temperature. So it only works as long as the ocean stays constant. Once warming starts to occur, as we see now, then you've got to backtrack and say, whoa, we're writing these equations wrongly. Let's put them formally in terms of temperature, which I did. And we kind of got away with it because, well, temperature goes exponentially down with depth. The real equations that we should be using, the Arrhenius equations, are also exponential functions of temperature. So it kind of looks almost right, but it's not. So I had to go back and look at what the original people did in the 1950s and the 1960s and do some detective work. Well, why did they write it that way? How do we change it? And once I'd gone through that analysis, it was pretty plain that because it was done one way back in, I think, 1962, everybody's gone along on the same track. It's time to rewrite things more professionally. We can't get away with shortcuts any longer, and that's what we did.
So we have to change science now that climate change has arrived.
Well, I think the rest of the world would think that's pretty old hat science. It's just that oceanographers have been a little bit lazy in the way we've dealt with it so far. And because the equations were about right, we could sort of get away with it. Those days are gone. And so by writing it out correctly in terms of the fundamental processes, all the data starts to fall in line rather beautifully. I must say that I'm lucky in that I was able to use other people's data. Some colleagues of mine at Woods Hole have written a beautiful paper on measuring oxygen consumption rates at a place off Bermuda, and I used their data. And in a second paper I've written for the Royal Society meeting, I've scanned the world. And I'm using data from colleagues in Germany, measurements on the Red Sea, measurements in the Southern Pacific. We pulled them all together, and I enormously respect the hard work that went into people getting those numbers. Just rewrote them in terms of more basic science. And once you do that, you can see rather plainly that the ocean behaves rather well. We know the energy involved in creating organic matter, and we know what's called the activation energy for how much work it takes to get over the energy barrier to consume it, and things fall out rather beautifully. So given that, we can now say, okay, here's the chemical side of the equation, and it contributes this much. My colleagues in physics, like John Shepard, will look at the stratification problem. And if you put a team together like this, we can make some large advances. But I think all of us are convinced it doesn't look very good.
You know, for me, one of the stunning factors is the time gap between mixing at the great depths and at the surface of the sea, where that's where the public interacts with the sea. We see this flat surface. We don't realize that it goes as deep as the highest mountains on land. So is it fair to say that the very bottom of the ocean is almost in a different age still, not yet part of the Anthropocene?
Well, it'll be true, yes. Some very good work on measuring minute changes at the very bottom of the ocean have shown that it does change. We got our first glimpse back in the 1970s when people began to map the distribution of radiocarbon from the bomb tests, and we could see it was penetrating deep into the sea. And today, if we look at the temperature structure of the ocean, you can see the global warming signal of the modern era penetrating down hundreds of meters. So in the depth regions that I've been discussing here, where there's already very low oxygen, have already been touched by modern-day warming. So yeah, the very deep waters of the ocean, thousands of meters deep, are going to be very slow to change. But there's going to be big changes, much shallower, just a few hundred meters, and that's where most of the marine life is, and it's where most of the concern is.
And I think we have, as a public who are somewhat informed about climate change, a picture of how hot it is now and how hot it could get if we get a certain amount of carbon in the atmosphere. But we don't have that picture for the oceans. I mean, what is the general temperature of the ocean now, and how hot do scientists expect it would get, say, on the worst-case scenarios?
Well, of course, the ocean and the atmosphere are well coupled. The atmosphere is warming well. The Arctic Ocean is warming. The semi-enclosed seas, like the Baltic and the Mediterranean, are warming fastest. Yeah, we can easily see 2 degrees Celsius warming, and probably more than that if we look at the real projections from the climate change plans. And so the ocean will eventually catch up to that. The surface water keeps track rather well. The upper few hundred meters lags within a few decades. So yeah, but people in their lifetime today, or young people in their lifetime today, will experience these changes. They're readily measurable. Any young scientist who comes to my lab, learns our lessons, and goes on ships with us and makes observations is fully embedded in this. Animals are tied to their specific ocean environment. Temperature's a great driver. And we will see marine populations be forced to move to try and adapt to their new surroundings. In general, animals are moving polewards in the ocean, in the northern hemisphere to the North Pole and the southern hemisphere to the South Pole. We're seeing coralline species move, all kinds of species, and they're on the march.
I think we'll be joining them.
Well, I hope not.
Well, it's nice in California now. Well, look, I realize it's still early days for this whole problem of marine deoxygenation, but for the sake of our poor listeners, is it time to be concerned about oxygen loss now, or is it just time to figure out the next research priorities?
Well, of course, the average person will not experience it. The atmosphere will be warm and fully oxygenated will be the same. But yeah, I did some research up off Vancouver Island, and we were down on the seafloor measuring some methane hydrates that were exposed there, and there was some nice big black fish swimming around, a couple of feet long. And so I looked at them, and I was told by my colleagues that there is a commercial fisheries there. Those fish will be gone under 2 degree warming. The oxygen levels are already fairly low. They're at their limit. And so I would say within the lifetime of a young person today, you know, fish that used to be caught off your part of the world will have to move. And so, yeah, your diet will be just changed. But it's a loss of carrying capacity of the ocean for the higher forms of life. The microbes will love it. The fish won't.
Is there anything I've missed or a message you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I think patience and respect for people who try and disentangle this mess. I'm somewhat embarrassed when I sat down and realized my colleagues had been writing out the equations probably not in the best way for about 50 years. It's rather alarming. What other mistakes have we made? So at each step along the way, we look at a problem, we try and solve it, we fix it, and we hope to communicate the ideas as best we can. But if I look at ocean acidification and this problem, the two of them together are a far bigger hit on life in the oceans than was ever dreamed of, say, 20 years ago. And that's what's worrisome.
And that's only 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah. when the first IPCC reports came out, you look back at what was said, and it's mild.
We've been speaking with the leading ocean scientist, Dr. Peter G. Brewer. He spent decades investigating the sea in some of America's top oceanographic institutes. He's now with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute in California. He's helping to organize the upcoming Royal Society meeting on ocean ventilation and deoxygenation in a warming world. You can find links to that, our guest's work, in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Peter Brewer, thank you for sharing your time and expertise with us.
Oh, thank you all.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Hello, I'm Alex Smith. Many of us are just trying to get through another week. So it's inconvenient when a news story flashes by another big warning sign of developing climate catastrophe, and I mean that, a catastrophe. Apparently the ocean and all the creatures in it could eventually end up gasping for oxygen. The science is so new, the issue so underestimated, this September the Royal Society is hosting a series of presentations on this topic. The title is Ocean Ventilation and Deoxygenation in a Warming World. The meeting is organized by Professor John Shepherd and two associates. Shepherd is a British Earth System scientist, a professor at the University of Southampton, and a former director of the National Oceanography Center. He's a fellow of the Royal Society. Professor Shepherd, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi.
Hi. So why are you organizing this meeting of scientists in September 2016?
We're organizing the meeting because we think there is an emerging issue that is not well enough understood scientifically and whose practical implications are not yet well enough understood either. So this is one of a series of meetings that the Royal Society organizes, and we try and latch on to upcoming subjects that are not yet fully worked out, that are really emerging in the scientific community and beyond.
Good. Well, let's get to the basics. What is deoxygenation of the ocean?
The ocean contains oxygen, and most of the ocean is fairly well oxygenated. That's to say the oxygen level is about as high as it could be, bearing in mind the solubility of oxygen in seawater. And this, of course, is very important for animals, particularly. Plants, as I'm sure your listeners know, produce oxygen, but animals mostly use oxygen. And so the presence of oxygen, even in the deep ocean, is very important for marine ecosystems. But oxygen is used up by plants and bacteria, animals and bacteria, and so it isn't 100% saturation everywhere. There's an oxygen minimum zone pretty much everywhere in the world ocean, and there are some regions which have become anoxic, and there is evidence that these are spreading for various reasons. Historically, the biggest reason has been because of nutrient runoff from land, eutrophication, causing excessive plant production and dead matter falling to the sea floor, where it uses up oxygen and creates anoxic zones, which may actually kill animals, although mostly they avoid such areas. So the level of oxygen in the ocean is important. And the new concern is that we have good reason to believe that global warming will also reduce oxygen levels in the ocean. And that's for two reasons. First reason is that most gases, including oxygen, are less soluble as the temperature warms up, which some people find surprising. It's the opposite of what you would expect with a solid compound. But for gases, that's the way it goes. And so as the ocean warms, we expect the dissolved level of oxygen to fall. But also, as the surface of the ocean warms, it becomes more highly stratified. That means we have lighter water on top of denser water. And that makes it more difficult to mix down from the surface, which is where the oxygen is coming in. We expect reduced ventilation of oxygen into the ocean interior. So for both of these reasons, we think that progressive ocean warming is going to reduce oxygen levels. There is observational evidence that that is already happening in some places. So far, the effect is not big. We don't really know how big it's going to be in the long run, or how serious that's going to be, or how it's going to interact with the biological processes that already reduce oxygen in the ocean. And that's why we're having the meeting, to explore these various processes, the way they interact, and to try and begin to figure out what the possible consequences may be.
And do we know the time scale of significant changes? Are we talking decades, centuries, longer?
Decades through centuries, certainly. Some effects, as I say, have already been observed, and we expect these to build up progressively over several centuries. So we don't expect to reach any sort of new steady state in this respect. Even if we manage to stabilize global surface temperatures, the heat will continue to propagate down into the ocean for several centuries. So this is a very long-running issue and possibly a very long-term problem.
And what do the paleo records tell us? Has this loss of oxygen happened before in previous warming periods?
Yes, that's right. That's a very interesting issue. We know that studies of ocean sediments particularly show that in the past, back in the Cretaceous period especially, let's say about 100 million years ago, the ocean repeatedly became anoxic. At least the deepest layers where the sediments were laid down became anoxic, and stayed that way for very long periods of time, hundreds of thousands, pushing up towards a million years at a time. And we don't know precisely why that happened. There are still conflicting theories about that. And we don't know how extensive those zones were or how they affected marine ecosystems, because we only have the fossil record to go on, and most of the life forms in the ocean don't fossilize very well. So we have a modern analog, interestingly, because the deeper regions of the Black Sea, deeper than about 500 meters, are anoxic at present and have been for a long time. And that is not necessarily catastrophic, because the surface of the Black Sea, the surface waters are still oxygenated and still support important fisheries and good functioning ecosystems. So nobody is, I hope, suggesting that this is, global catastrophe looming and we're all doomed. But there is a potentially serious problem that we need to understand better, and understanding what happened in the past will help us to understand what happens in the future, we hope.
So these dead zones, yes, I've read about them for years, talked about them on this show, and it is generally ascribed to agricultural fertilizers or other land-based pollution. But could it be more than that? Is deoxygenation due to warming oceans perhaps already somewhat at play?
Well, as I said, there are observations that suggest that the ocean warming is already having an effect, but that's mainly in the deep ocean. In these coastal areas where we have the dead zones at present, the temperatures already fluctuate a great deal, and the global warming signal would be relatively small compared to the natural fluctuations. So although there probably is some small effect, it's unlikely to be comparable to the natural seasonal fluctuations and the effect of fertilizers and other nutrient-rich runoff. Where we do probably, we'll expect to see the signal first, is in this oxygen minimum zone that I mentioned, which is typically a few hundred to a thousand meters down in the ocean. And we would expect to see that oxygen minimum level becoming lower, and this zone to be thickening. And those are the sorts of observations that we would be looking for. And the advantage of looking there is that because the conditions are relatively stable, it will be easier to see the signal than in coastal waters where there's a lot of year-to-year and seasonal fluctuation.
So the public has heard a lot more about ocean acidification, a chemical change in the seas. Is that a completely different problem from oxygen depletion, or are these problems interrelated in some way?
They are slightly interrelated. Fundamentally, ocean acidification is a chemical problem. We mostly know that carbon dioxide is a weakly acidic gas, forms a weak acid when it dissolves in water. And so simply putting carbon dioxide in the ocean is pretty much guaranteed to make it marginally more acidic, which is what we're observing. And we're still trying to understand fully what the ecological consequences of that will be. There is also an effect of temperature, because the various coefficients, chemical coefficients that control the level of acidity, are temperature dependent. So there's an interaction between acidification and temperature. And in the same way, there's an interaction between temperature and oxygen. And there may be some small chemical effects of the oxygenation, deoxygenation itself, because that is changing the chemistry. It's not directly affecting acidity, but there are probably subtle effects going on that, again, we need to work through and figure out what all these interactions may be.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Professor John Shepherd, a distinguished scientist who's helping to organize a meeting of scientists this September. They'll discuss the threat of lower oxygen levels in the seas as the world warms. So, John Shepherd, you spent over a decade studying fish population dynamics. What do we know about the impacts of lower oxygen levels on sea life, like the fisheries?
Well, we know that the deoxygenated zones that exist already have an impact on fisheries. You do get fish kills occasionally, and we do observe fish avoiding these areas, understandably. They're capable of sensing whether there's enough oxygen for them to function properly, and they can swim away. Plankton, of course, can't swim away in the same way. And for this reason, there is some evidence that these deoxygenated zones do affect the reproduction of fish, because most fish have planktonic eggs and larvae in their early life stages. And these, of course, can't swim fast enough to get away from the deoxygenated zones. So if these happen to correspond with spawning or nursery areas, then you would expect a population-level effect, and the fact that the adults can swim away is not going to prevent there being a problem. So far, these effects have not manifest themselves in terms of major fish population collapses, but that is always a possibility. It's not as worrying as it might otherwise be, because these oxygen minimum zones tend to be in areas of very high biological productivity. It's the high surface productivity and the export of biological material to the deep ocean, where the bacteria metabolize it, respire it, and use oxygen in the process. These high productivity is associated with the low oxygen zones deeper down. And the high productivity means that these are typically good areas for fish in the first place. I mean, a case in point might be off the coast of California or South Africa, where you have very productive ecosystems, areas of anoxia that appear to be expanding in a very episodic and uneven sort of way, but nevertheless do appear to be expanding. Whether there is an effect on fish in those areas, I'm not sure. You'd need to ask the experts on these fish stocks in those areas.
John, I know it's still early days, but are we studying a feedback system? Does ocean deoxygenation drive more loss of oxygen?
Not as far as I know. We are always worried about these feedback effects, and we do look for them. A feedback effect is also not necessarily catastrophic, because what it does is amplify the effects of external changes. It doesn't necessarily make them go into chain reaction situation. But positive feedbacks are very important in climate science, where the climate sensitivity is enhanced very considerably by a number of positive feedbacks that we know about. So far as we know, in the case of deoxygenation, something we call Le Chatelier's principle applies, and that is to say that the chemical and biological systems tend to react in such a way as to oppose or reduce the imposed change rather than amplifying it. But having said that, I wouldn't rule out that there's a process that nobody has yet thought of that might cause a positive feedback. The ones that I know about at the moment are mostly negative feedbacks that tend to reduce the impact of external changes rather than amplify them.
Who are some of the scientists presenting at the September meeting of the Royal Society, and what will they talk about?
Okay, we have a star-studded list of people who've worked on various aspects of these problems. I mean, we have a couple of people from the Scripps Institution for Oceanography in California, Ralph Keeling, who is probably the foremost scientist in the world in measuring oxygen in the atmosphere and also in the oceans, as well as other things. He's opening the whole session with a talk on what we actually know about oxygen in the atmosphere and the oceans. And then we have Lisa Levin talking about the ecological consequences of deoxygenation on the continental margins. So exactly this problem of the low oxygen zones that we were talking about before. We have Laurent Bopp from France talking about modeling of oxygen in global ocean models, which is something which is not yet done as well as we would like it to be. Ocean models are, if anything, still less well developed than atmospheric models. There are a number of processes that we find hard to represent, and we have to parameterize. And so Laurent will be talking about how well are we doing in modeling oxygen in the oceans. Andreas Oschlies from Germany will be talking about the oxygen minimum zone in low latitudes, that's to say near the equator, where this zone comes close to the surface and is particularly intense because of the high biological production there. And Peter Brewer from the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, also in California, will be talking about whether or not we are actually representing the interaction between the physical processes, the mixing processes, and the oxygen penetration into the ocean correctly, whether in fact would there are basic chemical processes that we could represent better in our models. I'm not going to give you the whole long list, but let's finish up by saying we have Andy Watson from the University of Exeter in the UK, who will be talking about the whole process of regulation of these biologically active chemicals in the ocean, and in particular anoxia in the past, as we were discussing before, the past climate record, and in the present ocean, and how we can apply the information from the past to the present and the future.
How can people find out more about this meeting before the fact, and will there be some way to find out what happened?
Yes, you can find out more about it by going to the Royal Society's website, royalsociety.org, and if you look for scientific meetings and search for ventilation, you'll find the web pages that are devoted to this with a complete list of speakers and the schedule and the opportunity to register for the event, which is free if you can get yourself to London for a couple of days. Our meeting room can hold in excess of 100 people. We're hoping to fill it up. And you will be able to find out about it afterwards, because all the talks that are given are going to be written up and will appear in a special issue of one of the Royal Society's journals, Philosophical Transactions, which we believe is actually the longest-running scientific journal in the world. It's been going for about 350 years and still going strong, and making a speciality of theme issues on subjects like this that are of a very general interest. So there's every opportunity to find out what's going on, either by being there or reading up about it afterwards.
Now, is there anything that I've missed that you would like to tell our listeners as we wrap up, John?
I think the thing I would like to stress is that this is an emerging issue scientifically. We don't yet fully understand the science. That's why we're having the meeting. We don't yet fully understand the ecological and socioeconomic consequences. There is genuine cause for concern, very strong reasons to believe that there is an emerging problem, but as of yet, we can't really say how big it is or how serious it's going to be. So watch this space. The scientific community is alerted to this problem and working on it fairly enthusiastically, and we hope to be able to tell your listeners and other people a lot more about it in the future.
The Royal Society is organizing a meeting of scientists this September to discuss ocean ventilation and deoxygenation in a warming world. Our guest is Professor John Shepherd from the University of Southampton. You can find links to the science, the meeting, and the subjects we've touched on in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Professor John Shepherd, thank you for sharing your time and good luck with the meeting this fall.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
Could human forcing of the climate take us to a new dangerous state of deserts and a drying sea? That worrying look at extreme possibilities arises from a paper published in the journal Nature Communications in February 2016. The paper claims humans can create the largest known climate feedback mechanism, so we do need to know what it's about. Our guide will be Dr. James Casting. He's the Evan Pugh Professor in the Department of Geosciences at Penn State University. Casting is an award-winning member of many scientific societies. He's published countless scientific papers since his first in 1977, including some dead-on for this topic. Jim Casting has worked for and with NASA all over the place. He's also part of NASA groups researching astrobiology and possible life on other planets. Dr. Casting, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
We're going to need to understand some new things to get the message of this study by Max Popp and his co-authors. And sort of to motivate us, I want to read you something that the authors conclude. They say, this study verifies the presence of the largest known feedback mechanism for amplifying anthropogenic climate change. Do you agree with that?
Well, I wouldn't say it verifies the feedback mechanism. What they're talking about is cloud feedback, and that's actually very controversial. It varies from one model to another.
Okay. Well, I'd like to get sort of an introduction to the paper step by step. And to start with, we read this: water-rich planets such as Earth lose water by photodissociation of water vapor in the upper atmosphere. Can you explain this further so the average person can understand it?
Photodissociation means splitting the water vapor molecule apart using solar ultraviolet radiation. And if you do that, you first convert H2O into H plus OH, and then you end up converting the OH into O and H, and so you have H atoms and O that recombines to form O2. So the hydrogen atoms, the H atoms, can escape to space, and then you're left with some oxygen, but the water is lost.
Okay, so this paper by Popper says, quote, but significant loss of water could occur over geological timescales, and I want to emphasize that, he's talking about long timescales, if the surface temperature were around 70 K warmer than it is today. Now that's in Kelvin. Unfortunately, most of us only understand temperatures in Fahrenheit or Celsius. If this is an important trigger point for significant water loss, how much warmer is 70 Kelvin from our present temperatures?
Well, first of all, the authors misspoke slightly there. What they should have said is you can start to lose a lot of water if you get to 70 degrees Celsius mean surface temperature. And, you know, the current mean surface temperature is 15 Celsius, which is 59 Fahrenheit. And so about a 55 degree Celsius or Kelvin increase in temperature would do it.
Is that a sliding scale? That is, if the Earth warms 8 or 10 degrees C, as seems quite likely on our current path of emissions, would loss of water to space be increased at a noticeable level?
No, it's really not much of an issue until you get up to these very high temperatures, you know, roughly 70 Celsius.
Okay. And what is a moist greenhouse state?
Moist greenhouse, it's better to define a runaway greenhouse first. That's when you evaporate all the surface water and create a steam atmosphere. A moist greenhouse, you still have liquid water on the surface, but the atmosphere becomes very water-rich, and the stratosphere becomes water-rich as well, so that you can then lose the water by the process we just talked about.
Well, I'm glad you raised that, because I'm wondering how this compares to the runaway greenhouse effect that James Hansen called the Venus syndrome.
It's a variant of the runaway greenhouse effect. And right now, in the literature, the climate modelers are basically having an argument about whether you get a moist greenhouse on the way to a runaway greenhouse or whether you just shift directly to a runaway greenhouse.
And were you involved when James Hansen was doing early work on the atmosphere of Venus?
No, but I've worked on the Venus runaway greenhouse, and you know we may have picked up where he left off. I worked with Jim Pollack out at NASA Ames on this problem many years ago.
So, as described in this paper in Nature Communications, various models have tested the relationship of water vapor as a potent greenhouse gas and global warming. And the results have been conflicting or inconclusive, or maybe models can't even do it. However, the introduction to the paper does say, if clouds are considered, these arguments may not apply because clouds themselves can contribute to the climate becoming unstable. How can clouds contribute to a climate becoming unstable?
Well, it's because clouds have different effects on climate depending on how high they are, what they're made of, and how thick they are. So most low clouds, like cumulus clouds and stratus clouds, tend to cool the Earth because they reflect sunlight to space and it makes it cooler at the surface. But high cirrus clouds, which are made of ice crystals, actually amplify the greenhouse effect more than they increase the Earth's reflectivity. So they warm the climate.
And there's some discussion in the paper about human-forced warming versus the long-term warming we expect from the sun. And it's my understanding that over more than a billion years, far more, the sun will get hotter as it expands, eventually rendering Earth uninhabitable for anything living, maybe 3 billion years from now. Did I get that right, for starters?
Yeah, actually, not just 3 billion years. The sun's getting brighter about 1% every 100 million years. So in 1 billion years, it'll be about 10% brighter, and that in our models would be enough to cause a moist greenhouse and lose the water.
So we've only got a billion years left.
Only a billion, that's right. It's not that scary.
So one key question investigated in this paper is whether human-forced warming can mimic or duplicate the role of that warming sun we've just discussed. What did they find?
Well, they found that it could, and this was the interesting part of the paper. They found that an increase in CO2 by about a factor of 4, I think, in their model, pushed you up to a moist greenhouse. But, you know, you should qualify that because their base model was about 6 degrees Celsius warmer than the modern Earth. They had a model with no continents. And for reasons I don't entirely understand, it was much warmer than the present climate. So actually, the moist greenhouse is not as imminent as their paper might make it look.
Yeah, all right. Now, they say these cloud effects come due to a weakening of the large-scale circulation with increasing global mean surface temperature. What are they talking about?
That's the second cloud effect. They actually have two cloud feedbacks in this model. If you start from the base temperature and increase the solar forcing or CO2, then they get a positive cloud feedback because they produce deeper convection and more cirrus clouds. That's true of many models that the IPCC uses to evaluate global warming. But then when they go to much higher surface temperatures, the effect that you just mentioned kicks in. They get more widespread clouds, and they start to cool.
So I guess Venus is generally under a great cloud. Is that correct?
Well, you know, the Venus clouds are made of sulfuric acid rather than pure water vapor. And they're photochemical clouds. They form from photolysis of SO2. They're kind of like Earth clouds, but in other ways, they're not the same.
Now, unlike Hansen's suggestions a few years ago, this paper finds Earth is more likely to enter a new stable state. Why doesn't the runaway greenhouse effect happen?
It's because of the second cloud feedback, which is negative, so that when you know their model jumps up to this warm, moist greenhouse state, but then when they increase the forcing pass there, they start to get negative cloud feedback. The clouds become widespread and lower, and that prevents the runaway greenhouse.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. We're looking at a disturbing new study from The Science titled Transition to a Moist Greenhouse with CO2 and Solar Forcing. And our guest is Dr. James Casting from the Department of Geosciences at Penn State University. The authors of this study describe an ocean which could be literally scalding hot. For instance, Wikipedia says the long-term global average surface temperature of the ocean is about 16 degrees C or 60 degrees Fahrenheit. This paper is talking about an ocean that's 41 degrees hotter C or 74 degrees hotter Fahrenheit. You'd be in there for about 15 seconds before you scald. Is this really possible?
It is possible. But, you know, we wouldn't live to see it because we actually, long before we lost the water, we would be cooked because we have a heat stress threshold, which is well below that.
Yeah. Do we know what the global mean land temperature might be if the oceans were that hot, or is that even worth figuring out?
It would be very similar. So if you have really warm oceans like that, you get a lot of moisture in the atmosphere. The atmosphere then has a huge heat capacity. And more importantly, it's very optically thick, so the temperatures would become very uniform around the globe, including on the continents.
And that sounds to me like a dead planet, except for maybe those bacteria that can survive around the rims of volcanic heat vents. Is that a reasonable conclusion?
There are hyperthermophilic bacteria that can survive all the way well above 80 degrees Celsius. So not all life would be extinguished, but most of the life that we're familiar with on the continents, including us, would be extinguished.
Are there other planets out there in that state?
Well, that's one thing that NASA hopes to find out. In our own solar system, Venus, we think, went through this type of episode early in its history, and then it ended up in the very hot state that it's in right now. But NASA's designing telescopes as we speak that will look for planets around other stars and see whether any of them might be Earth-like or Venus-like or somewhere in between.
Even with the climate change predicted by the IPCC, there's a lot of talk about deserts increasing, even while extreme flooding and heavy rainfall events also increase. I'm presuming from what I'm hearing from you so far that those changes in the hydrological cycle are just a tiny subset and not directly related to the extreme changes that Max Popp and his authors are talking about.
That's right. The Popp et al. Study is not directly relevant to modern global warming because it looks like it would go to a moist greenhouse with a factor of 4 increase in CO2, which you could do by burning fossil fuels. But really, you need another factor of 4 increase to go from the Earth's present climate up to their base state. So really, it would take more like a factor of 20 increase, 16 or 20, to get to the state that Popp et al. Talk about.
So if anybody takes this paper and then says, well, that shows we're just rapidly heading for extinction, they're going way too far.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Jim Casting, perhaps the most worrying sentence, or like a death sentence really, occurs at the end of the paper's abstract. Max Popp and his group write, furthermore, there is hysteresis in the warm regime, and removing the imposed forcing does not, therefore, necessarily cause a transition back to an Earth-like climate. And for listeners, hysteresis is sort of like a memory that can drive further action from past states. Can you talk to us about the drivers that would prevent ever returning to an Earth-like climate?
Yeah, you should say hysteresis, and it's clouds in their model that give you hysteresis. In other words, the behavior of the system is not directly reversible. The best analogy is with an electromagnet. When I was a kid, I used to take a copper wire and wind it around a nail and then attach the ends to a battery, and you make an electromagnet. Well, if you do that to the nail several times, you can then take off the copper coils, and the nail is still magnetized. That's because there's hysteresis in the magnetic minerals. So the climate system, they're arguing, is the same way. Once you get it into this moist greenhouse state, it's not that easy to get back down from there.
Well, given the large-scale uncertainties here and the roughness of the models available, as you said, to calculate such big changes, I'm going to call this moist greenhouse state paper a theory. Would you agree with that?
Yes. But as I said, it's testable not so much on Earth, we hope, but by looking at planets around other stars. And that's why the paper is really of interest to me.
Obviously, then, the latest report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the Paris talks, they wouldn't have even considered this theory of water loss to space.
No, they're not that concerned about that. But they should be concerned about human heat stress, which, as I said, kicks in well before all of these effects that Pope et al. Are talking about. You know, the IPCC is worried about many of the effects of global warming, sea level rise, human heat stress, changes in water availability. And so they're actually doing a very useful service for us all.
Where does a theory like this go from here? What sort of research is needed and how imperative is it?
Well, we really need to advance our study of Earth-like planets in general. We need for very different groups to be doing these three-dimensional climate models, because that's what determines the boundaries of the habitable zone around our sun and other stars. So I was very happy to see this nice study, which references most of the work that has been done recently and should provide motivation for others to do the same types of things.
Do you think it's too harsh for me to say that maybe this largest known feedback mechanism is so far away the public doesn't really need to know about it right now while scientists continue to hash it out?
I think that's a fair enough statement. But those of us that are interested in habitable planets will pay attention to this paper.
Even without this paper, as we wrap up, are you personally concerned that we will wreck the climate that nature and humanity have depended on?
I'm very concerned. And, you know, as I said, heat stress is maybe the most imminent problem. We're not that far away from making a climate that's basically too warm for us to live in without air conditioning. And, you know, this is more true in the tropics than it is elsewhere on the globe. But that is something we could do to ourselves within the next, say, 50 to 100 years.
Yeah, I just did a show on that about extreme heat in India and Pakistan recently, and also in the Middle East, Abu Dhabi, places like that. They're approaching the combination of heat and humidity where it's just not safe to go outside.
That's exactly right. And so as the climate warms, those places would be the first places on Earth that might become basically uninhabitable.
Where should our listeners go to find out more about you and to track some of the work that you're interested in?
You can go to my webpage at Penn State, which I update some of the times. You can Google me. And if you're a scientist, you can go on Web of Science, which has access to all of my papers.
And there's a lot of them. Have you counted them up?
I think Web of Science finds around 180 or something like that.
We've been talking with Dr. James Casting, the Evan Pugh Professor at the Department of Geosciences at Penn State University. He's been in and out of NASA, as you've heard, and he's interested in other planets as well. You can find links to the work of James Casting, the full text of this paper by Pope et al., and other things that we've talked about here in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much, Dr. Casting, for sharing your valuable time with us. I appreciate it.
Okay, well, thank you for interviewing me.
Be sure and check my weekly show blog, including bonus comments this week, by the Moist Greenhouse lead author, Max Popp. That's from our private telephone interview. Blog readers get an extra helping at ecoshock.info. Please listen again next week as Radio EcoShock pushes the edge.